All right, everybody should have heard that. It is terrific to have Dr. Katie Witkiewicz on this call with us as our guest. Dr. Witkiewicz is, I will say first, she is the now president of Division 50 of the American Psychological Association, or the Society of Addiction Psychology, and she is also an associate professor at the Department of Psychology at the University of New Mexico, right up the block from where we're going to be having our upcoming CPA conference. So we want to make sure we put in several plugs for that. That'll be in March. And Katie, I think people can get hotel rooms now, I think.
They can, and they can register as well.
Wonderful. So more about who you are and what you've done will come up in the conversation. So I don't want to give away anything. So it's so nice to have you online. There's a good number of people online already, I think it's more than a dozen. So people like Noah are online, among others, and Lauren, and who else? Just real quick,
Ben and Tessa from UF.
Tessa and
Phil Bellman.
Phil, you're on the line.
Hi, Katie.
More people.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Tessa.
So, and there are lots more. So rather than clog up the call with having everyone say their name, please, Katie, tell us about yourself and what your talk is about and what made this your topic. I love it.
Well, I'm an associate professor at the University of New Mexico. I'm president of Society of Addiction Psychology, and I am just so busy writing letters of recommendation for everyone and also coaching my own graduate students on their upcoming interviews for internship and postdoc, and talking to my undergrads about their applications for graduate school. So it made me realize that there's a lot of people right now dealing with this period of transition of thinking about what you're going to be doing next year or in the future for those of you who are way ahead of the game. And I just thought, why not spend some time talking about it? And I really would hope that today could be more open question and answer. I'm happy to give my story of how I ended up in the places I did, which is a little bit circuitous and not planned at all. And so I thought that could be helpful too, to just maybe alleviate some anxiety around the fact that you don't necessarily have to know where you're going. You just have to put one foot in front of the other every step. So I had no intention of ending up at University of New Mexico. That wasn't my long-term vision by any means, but I'm super thrilled to be here. So it all works out in the end.
Great. Start. That's a great start. Thank you. I want to tell everyone, just in case you don't, well, I think everyone knows, Katie, you might not. The ding sounds mean people that are coming on the line. So that's a good tiny interruption. The other interruption can be if people haven't put their phone on mute and anything is going on in the background, including even shuffling papers, taking notes, typing on your computer. So please, Until you want to talk, just please make sure your phone's on mute. So, Katie, I know you well, and yet I don't know everything about you. Please tell us about this journey that you started to describe in the description of today's conversation.
Sure, happy to. And I'm getting a bit of an echo now, but that's okay. So, before I begin, I'd love to know just composition of where people are on the call. Do we have anyone who's currently applying to graduate school?
That's a good question. We sometimes have undergraduates. Anyone on the call? I know there are people applying to internships. So
okay. So no one. So I won't highlight the pieces of the trajectory that are irrelevant to everyone on the call. So no one applying to graduate school. Who's applying to internship?
Hi, this is Noah Emery. I am currently.
Okay. Anyone else?
I'm not currently, but I'm considering that when I finish my degree.
Okay. Okay. And anyone applying to postdocs or jobs?
I'm applying to postdocs. Lauren.
Great.
This is Emily. I'm applying to postdocs and assistant faculty positions.
Great. Excellent. Okay, so we're highlighting the internship and the potential job postdoc question and not so much the graduate student question. However, there's some of you, at least I know Tessa on the call, who are way ahead of the game of already starting to think about internship.
Working on it.
Or postdoc.
Postdoc.
Yeah, we're still postdocs.
Okay, both postdocs. That's right. You guys are not clinical, so you don't have to worry about the dreaded internship year. Okay, so that gives me a really good sense. So I won't highlight too much of the run-up to graduate school since it sounds like almost everyone on the call is a current grad student. Do we have anyone at the postdoc level who's applying for jobs currently or grants?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we're going to highlight the latter half of my journey. But the beginning is fun, so I'll spend just a bit on that. It's a lesson, and you never know what's going to happen. And a little bit of luck, too. I feel very fortunate and lucky in my path. And that is because I initially really didn't have a good sense of what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be a faculty member. Someday. That was my long-term dream from beginning in undergrad in a psychology department. That's one thing I knew. And I knew I wanted to get a PhD and do research and teaching. And I was challenged by a chair at my undergrad institution who said I would never get into a clinical psychology program. And I had never even thought about clinical until that moment. And he thought I was instantly thinking of clinical, and that's why he said it, that he was guiding me away from clinical. But I had never even thought about clinical. But then he told me I couldn't do it. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't like that feedback. I don't like being told I can't do something, that I won't achieve something. It's kind of a challenge. So I decided to put in my grad school list, you know, of places I was applying to. I was applying to mostly developmental and quantitative programs, but I threw in a clinical program too. Just to see. And lo and behold, I got into a couple of developmental programs, but I ended up getting into the University of Montana clinical program. And so I went because he said I could never do it. So there was lots of other things going on that went into my decision, including the excitement about getting a degree in clinical. And I really liked the program at Montana, and I really didn't like some of the other places I had applied to and was accepted. So ultimately, you know, packed up my car and moved to Montana. And then got there, and the person I went to work with was no longer doing research. So remember, I started this by saying I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a researcher and a teacher and a faculty member. And so that when I show up at Montana, my initial mentor is not even doing research. Basically had a dysfunctional lab completely, nothing going on. So I was stuck then without a mentor and fortunately landed in a lab that was studying addiction. Dr. Michael Hufford took me in my first year, and he was studying alcohol and smoking. And that's how I became an addiction researcher, honestly, is luck of the draw of the one mentor at University of Montana who would take me in. Unfortunately, by the end of my first year of graduate school, he let his students in his lab know that he was leaving, and he was leaving for industry, and so he couldn't take us with him, obviously, to a pharmaceutical company, and so then I was stuck kind of already at the end of my first year, second mentor now leaving, and so I, at that point, decided I wanted to at least get a master's degree out of this adventure, and so I proposed my thesis by the end of my first year. Michael agreed to serve as my chair, even from afar, and then defended it by December of my second year. And at that point, the plan was that I was going to drop out of graduate school and move back to upstate New York, where I was from. And luck of the draw, I met Alan Marlatt at a poster session at ABCT. It was then AABT. And Alan asked me what I was doing, and I said, oh, I'm about to drop out of graduate school. And he said, no, you're not. You're applying to the University of Washington. And so I did. and then he accepted me there, and I finished my PhD there. So I'll stop there because I feel like I've been talking forever. And just there's been a lot of more people joining the line. Welcome, everyone. Bruce, do you want to interrupt me at all? Feel free.
Oh, God, I've been taking notes. I am so you've brought so many things to mind. You know, a lot of people have heard that expression. If you tell me I can't do something, I'm going to do it. It's going to make me more determined to do it. But when you said it, I really wanted to think about it and take it seriously. There's a certain amount of risk-taking that's necessary to push the boundaries and get to do as much as you've ultimately gotten to do. And if you play by the rules all the time and you do what you're told all the time, it could be harmful. And it's also, I'm just basing this on what you've been saying, you know, the willingness to tolerate ambiguity. And when I say risk-taking, another way to put it is put yourself out there. So in order to do all the stuff the students online want to do, they have to be pretty conformist. But there are times to be a conformist, and Katie, in your case, certainly a time to be a nonconformist. So that's
sure.
My thought on
yeah.
What you've said so far.
For sure, yeah. I think there's a lot to say for that. On a day-to-day basis, I tote the line and I do what I'm supposed to do. But I think there is something for taking some risks now and again and being open to what life throws at you. I had based my entire master's thesis on Alan Marlatt's work. And when he came up to me at a poster session, I mean, one, I was terrified, of course. I was literally shaking. People kind of around me must have thought I was having a seizure. I was so nervous to be talking to the great Alan Marlatt at my poster session. And I, you know, didn't shy away, though. I took that as an opportunity to talk about the work I was doing and show my enthusiasm for the work and asked him questions about what he thought about this. And I really think it helped me to kind of put away my shyness for a second and to actually just be really assertive around the fact that I was doing something that I thought he might find interesting. So I think there comes a time where, you know, stepping out of our comfort zones a little bit really can be quite helpful and even transformative.
Katie, there's something else I know about you, especially now that you're president of our division. And that is that once you'll take, I'm thinking of the metaphor of riding a bike. You know, you got to get some momentum up. But if you stop the momentum, the bike will fall over. It won't just balance there. And I've seen you take on a number of big things like the proficiency issue and other issues. And you know that you can't stop pedaling. And you keep everybody else around you pedaling. You can take risks and you can tolerate ambiguity, but if you try to rest on your laurels, if you try to take a break from something you're taking a big risk on, there's a good chance you won't succeed. And you really don't stop once you set your mind to doing something that's important. So besides that being a compliment, I wonder if you can comment on observations you've made about, for students online maybe in particular, the importance of not thinking that, when is it time to rest, but when is it time to absolutely not rest?
Yeah.
And keep going.
No, that's a great point, because I certainly, I mean, one piece of advice for everyone is follow through on your commitments. It's so important. And not just for your own professional development and career, but also for maintaining collaborations with people. You know, one thing that's really helped me in my career is having great collaborators. And I have great collaborators because I don't drop the ball. You know, I really try hard not to drop the ball. I have dropped the ball. It happens, right? Anything's going to happen. But in general, trying to, like Bruce said, keep paddling. And you might have to slow down, right? You can't always go full speed ahead. But not ever stopping, not ever dropping the ball, especially when working with others, is really important. And following through on your commitments is really important. And And when have I dropped the ball is probably a question. How do you know when it's okay to drop the ball versus when it really isn't? And I think the general rule of thumb is generally it isn't, right? So keep those balls in the air. Keep that bike pedaling generally. The few times I have let things go or said no or decided this was a losing battle is when, you know, you're spinning your wheels, right? Like when the chain falls off, for example, you can't keep pedaling. The chain falls off, you're stuck, right? If you keep pedaling, you're just wasting energy, right? So when things totally fall apart, you know, that's when you stop pedaling, or when there's just no hope that anything is going to come from what you're doing.
You know, I was thinking about the people on the communications committee. I know that Noah and Lauren are online. I know that David has to teach, and I know that Joseph is tied up with something else. But I don't know about you, Katie, but I'm more likely to watch how a student does when they're well into something than right at the beginning, because everybody's full of bubbly energy at the beginning of everything they think they're going to be able to do. But like watching the students on the communication committee just not stop after even a couple of years, it means even more when you work hard later in a project versus just when the project is new and shiny and fresh. A project like this, like these live podcasts.
Yeah, no, I agree. I there's something to perseverance as well. I think there's a lot I've persevered through, and you know, losing two mentors in my first year of graduate school was one of them. And not giving, I almost gave up. I was really, really close to giving up. And, you know, I was fortunate to meet Alan and then have a path to not give up. I think there have been other times when I persevered and then changed course, you know. And so I think I'd like to move on to kind of the next steps, because I really want to focus on questions that folks have and how to take those next steps after graduate school.
Terrific.
But I think that the idea of being a good collaborator and being consistent and working hard through adversity are keys to all of this.
Now, do you need questions, or would you like to continue?
I would love to entertain a question.
All right, gang. I know there are lots of people, more people than usual on the call, as you can tell from the dings. So please jump in.
I have a question about, I'm a doctoral student finishing up a degree in sociology.
Uh-huh.
And I'm interested in studying addictions as a researcher using some of the methods that are not so common, like possibly classic grounded theory method or, you know, something other than the usual laboratory research on animal brains and MRI studies and those things.
Uh-huh.
Is there any place for new, you know, I guess new approaches in research in addictions? I don't know much about the field, so I don't really know what's happening, if there's a trend or new windows opening up for different kinds of research.
Definitely. So qualitative research has a strong tradition in addiction and continues to be widely used. And I think the important piece to know is that qualitative research can be and should be as rigorous as quantitative research.
That's why I'm doing grounded theory, right?
Yeah. So I think a really important way to kind of make your way in this field with that, because it is harder. I'm not going to shy away from the fact that as an editor of journals and as a reviewer, it's, you know, the work that goes into qualitative work is so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it really takes that added rigor of the qualitative work to make it competitive for journal space. And so I would recommend looking at some of the work of Joanne Neal in the UK. She has done a tremendous amount of excellent quantitative work, or qualitative work, with addiction and is really quite spectacular. And her last name is Neale, N-E-A-L-E.
Okay.
And she is just phenomenal. Another person who is on the periphery of addiction, but she's a collaborator of mine now at University of New Mexico and has really built a career on qualitative work, is Nina Wallerstein.
Okay.
And so if I were you, and at this stage, and this kind of goes to anyone, this is a general comment, if you have an idea of what you want to do, look for people who've been successful in doing that. And then look at their vita and see what did they do at various points in their career. What did they do to get to where they are now? And really, I mean, that's kind of what I did with Alan. Once I started working with Alan, I was able to see, here's someone who's been very successful in addiction. What did he do?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things he did was become president of the Society of Addiction Psychology. So I put that high on my list of something I eventually wanted to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for these folks who have been really successful in their careers in doing qualitative research, Joanne Neale, particularly with addiction, Nina Wallerstein on the periphery, she does more social justice prevention kind of stuff. But looking at their vitas, looking at their career and seeing how did they get there, and then using that as a guide. So what kind of postdocs did they do? What kind of people did they work with? That gives you a sense of who can help elevate you in that niche area.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Just one other little follow-up on that. Is it uncommon for research studies to have a team of both qualitative and quantitative researchers?
That's not uncommon at all. No, that's actually quite common. Another group that's been doing that quite successfully is the Alcohol Research Group and Leanne Cascudas. They've been doing that quite well for many years, and they often have prevention and treatment and qualitative and quantitative. Yeah, that's quite common. And in fact, the grant that I'm working on with Nina Wallerstein, she's very much qualitative, and I'm bringing a quantitative piece.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions?
I was going to just say that delay is worth waiting because there will be questions if we delay, but we won't have to. Please proceed.
Hi, my name is Christina, and I'm actually the student rep for ETC, so it's been really great to join this call and hear more about your journey. I did have a question about maintaining a balanced life in the process, and that was included in your description, and it sounded like you had a pretty tumultuous experience in graduate school. And I was just wondering if you had any tips for us doctoral students right now.
Yeah, I think I do. And I certainly was able to maintain balance through all of that through a really good support network, first of all. So, you know, what I always tell my graduate students is be friends with your lab mates, be friends with your colleagues in graduate school. And for me, that's what really saved me. And I am still, we were a cohort of five in the clinical program, and I am still best friends with all five of those people, or all four of those people and me. And so even though I was only there a short time, we just had such great bonds, and they were really supportive. And being a good friend to others, right? Like, I think a lot of what comes from balance is actually being good to other people, and then, you know, they will be good to you when you need them, which is how all good relationships work. But having good friendship networks is really, really important. And then I always have had a motto of work hard, play hard. And so I actually really, I don't take a lot of time off. I really don't. And when I do, I completely check out of work and do something I really, really enjoy. And so I think the idea of balance is a personalized one, right? And it really comes from figuring out what you enjoy, figuring out what nourishes you, and then trying to build that in as much as you can. Now, that being said, I also am a little bit annoyed by the work-life balance people who criticize working too hard. I derive so much of my pleasure and nourishment from my work. Mm-hmm. And And I think if you're not deriving a lot of pleasure and nourishment from your work, then maybe considering a different research topic or a different area. I mean, certainly we all have bad days, right? We all have days that we would rather not have in our jobs. But if your work is not bringing you any enjoyment and any nourishment, then that's a big deal, and I would talk to a mentor about that. Because I
right.
really think it's hard to succeed in this field and in this world of academia and this world of soft money or heart or clinical work or whatever you're going to do if you're not driving any pleasure and enjoyment from the work that you're doing. So I guess my three biggest tips are be a good friend and have good friends if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Find what you love to do outside of work that's really nourishing and try to work it in as best you can. And then three, try to really enjoy what you do. And sometimes, you know, so for me, I am happiest ever when I'm running analyses. and so especially if I'm just at home with my dog nearby, running models, running analyses, that's like my happiest day. And I have found that at certain points in my career when I'm doing that less, I'm less happy in my job. And so that kind of thing, too, of figuring out what kind of things make you happy in the work you're doing, what kind of things do you really enjoy doing, and try as best you can to bring that in as much as you can, is, you know, assuming that that's also in the service of your career. Right? Like, if I mm-hmm. love data entry, which I don't, but if I did, it probably wouldn't serve my career so well to focus only on that. Right? You have to do other things that serve your career, but I do think that finding what you really love in your career and trying to, you know, at least be present when you're doing it and definitely working it in as much as you can. I've, you know, created a schedule now for myself where I've always got a paper I'm doing analyses for. And that just keeps me really happy at my job.
Awesome. Great. Thank you.
I know that's a popular topic, so I'm going to pause to see if there's any other questions related to finding balance, maintaining a clear head through all of this craziness.
I'll let you decide how long you want the pause to be, because it's worth it often.
All right. I'm going to let that be the pause because I want to jump into the next part. So now I'm in grad school at the University of Washington with Ellen Morlatt and finally finding my way kind of in becoming an addiction researcher. And so I want to jump kind of fast forward to the internship process because I know a lot of you on the call are in that process. And also kind of in the meantime, talk a little bit about kind of how to prepare yourself best for both internship and the job market. Because if you're on this call, you're probably interested in ultimately getting a job, I would think. So one thing is, you know, I rarely said no during that stage. I took a lot on. And that really was a great idea. That really served me well, I think. I think, you know, especially taking stuff on, not saying no to opportunities that have the potential to advance your career down the road, and that includes, you know, getting involved with our division, Society of Addiction Psychology, getting involved with reviewing manuscripts, if you can. I devoted almost a year of graduate school to helping Alan and Dennis Donovan publish two books. And I'm not on those books, and I didn't, you know, I got recognized. Sorry, my phone is ringing, my other phone. I got recognized in the acknowledgement section, but it was really almost a full year of my life where I was really helping to edit those volumes for Alan and Dennis. And at the time, I remember being really grumpy about it, as you can imagine. So there's a lot you might say yes to that you're grumpy about. But in the long run, I, you know, at a time later in my career, I really needed Dennis for something, and he totally came through for me. And, you know, I learned in the process how to edit a book, and I've, you know, since have edited four books. So it's, one of those things where even if you feel like at the time, like, oh, I don't know if this is the best use of my time, I'm not getting any credit for it, there's things that you can say yes to that, that ultimately down the line can be really important for your career. And so I always encourage my students to say yes a lot and to be very selective when saying no. And if I could come up with a single guideline for saying no, I don't know if I can come up with a single guideline because it really depends on the situation and the other person. I guess.
Katie, how about going back to the early thing, stuff we were talking about, where say no if you're going to drop the ball.
Yeah, say no if you're going to drop the ball, for sure, for sure. If I had said yes to Alan and Dennis, and then midway through the project, when I was super fed up with it, which I was, pulled out, then. I mean, they would have been in the lurch, and it would have been a really awful thing for my career. So, yeah, that's a really good – that's rule number one. Don't, you know, say no if you can't follow through. I also think say no if the person's possibly going to be an unreliable collaborator, if there's any indication – you know, if someone asks you to do something and you've heard that that person might not follow through themselves, that that person often drops the ball – then you could end up, you know, in the reverse scenario of putting a ton of effort and work into something that you needed someone else to help you with, to finish the job, and then the job doesn't get done. And that's really frustrating. I've had that happen to me quite a few times, you know, where I've worked on grant applications with people that have never actually gotten submitted because they were the principal investigator and they dropped the ball, or papers that I, you know, did. There's actually one paper I did the analyses for this paper and wrote up the whole results and part of the discussion section, I think 5 years ago now, and that paper still has not been submitted. So, you know, stuff like that where if there's any inclination that the person is potentially going to drop the ball themselves, then that's maybe a time to say no.
Dr. Wickowitz?
Yeah.
This is Desiree Moskow at SU. I'm really glad to be hearing your talk. I have a follow-up question on that.
Sure.
When you've found yourself in those situations that, you know, somebody else is dropping the ball, I mean, I'm sure I can imagine a lot of, like, kind of bitterness and things like that coming up. But, of course, you want to, you know, kind of keep it professional and make sure that you're not having any bad blood kind of out there. I'm wondering how you would suggest kind of addressing that if, like you said, somebody else is kind of heading up the project but dropping the ball after you've done all of this work.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Desiree. So two things that I've done in the past, actually three that I've done in the past. The first is to actually just have a really frank conversation. If I'm in the place to do this, have a frank conversation with the person about taking it over. So I have a couple of papers, actually, that I started out as second or third author, and I'm now first author because the person mm-hmm. dropped the ball, and I had a really frank conversation with them saying, I really think this is an important paper. I really want to get this out there. Is it okay if I take the lead and take this over? Because I don't see you making any progress on this. So that's the first thing, and that's always worked well. Oftentimes, in the three occasions I'm thinking of off the top of my head, the person was very relieved to be relieved of the job. I mean, no one wants to drop the ball. That's a horrible feeling, right? When you're the collaborator who's being not a good collaborator, that feels awful. And I've been on that side of the coin too. You know, I did mention I dropped the ball a couple times, and when I've been that side, it feels terrible. No one wants to be bad at what they do, and no one wants to let other people down. So mm-hmm. having some kind of recognition that they probably, now of course there's personality disordered folks, but let's go back to generally mm-hmm. people don't want to let you down. So that's one way of addressing it, is to really just take the lead, you know, and be assertive in asking the other person to take the lead. A second thing to do is to have a conversation around just kind of what's getting in the way for them, you know, kind of putting on some motivational interviewing skills and asking what's getting in the way, what would help them get the project to the finish line, having an mm-hmm. open conversation about that and hopefully inspiring them to move forward. And then third, just letting it go. I mean, there's, you know, not taking it too personally. You know, most people that where this has happened to me, it's not that they had a vendetta to screw me over, you know, to have me work really hard on something and then ultimately not get any prize from it. There's not malintent, typically. And so having some, you know, acceptance and patience around this is the process, and some things don't get done in our careers, and that's okay. You know, that's really served me well. The one right now where it's like 5 years on, it almost becomes funny at a point. So I think having a bit of a sense of humor around like, this happens sometimes and it's okay. You know, the world continues to turn. Even though that one project you worked really hard on is not coming to fruition, it's okay. There's going to be other projects for you to work really hard on.
It's interesting, Katie, one of the things I was thinking about as you said that is what a small world psychology is, but what a teeny, teeny, tiny world addiction psychology is. And you can drop the ball once or twice, but it's such a small world that if you do it too many times, it won't take many times to have a reputation. And
And that's another thing I was going to say. I mean, one other really big take-home message for all of you is that exact point. It is such a small world in our little field here. And we have to support each other, and we have to be good to each other as best we can. And you know, another thing that's really served me well related to that is, because if the times I have dropped the ball, I've owned that. You know, I've really owned it, and I've apologized, and I've done what I could to make it better. I've been in a situation actually where I saw that it was me holding up a paper, and so I had that conversation. The first step of just have a conversation with the other authors and see if anyone wants to take the lead. So I've done that myself, where I was holding something up and said, "Does anyone want this? Like, I can't do this right now. I'm happy for anyone to take this over." And so that's another really important point, because I've worked with people in this field who've dropped the ball again and again and again, and I won't work with them anymore, and I won't recommend them for things. And I, you know, that's the other side. There's two sides of it, too. So, and those are people who typically haven't owned it. You know, they've dropped the ball and have not owned it at all, and that's not okay. So speaking of that, let's talk a little bit about those of you, so applying for internship, going on the interviews. Many of you are probably getting calls right now about interviews coming up. And so there's decisions to be made. I was a bit strange and applied to internship really early. So I had done my year and a half at Montana, and then basically in my third year at Washington, applied to internship. And I don't know why I was rushing so much, honestly. If I could have it to do over again, I would have spent as long as possible in graduate school, within reason. I don't know why I was rushing to get through it, but it turns out, and I'm sorry if this is sad news, but graduate school is great. It was like the best time of my life. I don't know why I rushed so far to get out. So not that it doesn't get any better. I don't want to give that impression. But it is a really good time, so cherish it as much as you can. But I was rushing to get out, probably because of I was feeling like probably many of you are feeling right now, of sick of being poor and wanting to move on and actually be a professional. And I didn't apply to that many programs, so I think that's really relevant. I didn't do like the full 12 or 13 programs that they recommend. I think I only applied to 6 internship sites. And I had this mentality, which was terrible at the time, of, well, if I don't match, I don't match, and I'll apply next year, and I'll do the full thing next year. That was a really bad mentality. I don't recommend it. But it ultimately worked. And so I'll talk now about the interview process. And one thing is, because I've seen this happen, if you get 12 interviews, you don't have to do 12 interviews. be selective. you know, don't kill yourself going on every single interview that you get. Pick the top 8 or 9 that seem like really good programs, because if you get 12 interviews, you're a great candidate for internship. If you get 9 interviews, 8 interviews, 7 interviews, you're a great candidate. A lot of sites want to meet you, interact with you. That's a good sign that you can be a little bit more selective and maybe not kill yourself on interviews, because it does. It's a grueling month. Having a student who just went through it last year and having 2 students going through it this year, it's really quite grueling. And then on the interviews themselves, I think it's really important to be yourself, to know that you're interviewing them just as much as they are interviewing you. And really, and this is the most important thing, be kind to your fellow interviewees. Again, the small field thing. So I interviewed with people who I now interact with on study section. Okay? Right? Like, you're going to see these people again. And if you're a jerk on interview trying to be, like, the smartest one in the room, people are going to remember that. And they're going to remember it when they're reviewing your papers and when they're reviewing your grants. So be yourself. And if yourself is not a good person, then try really hard to be a good person. And be kind and realize that you're all in it together. You don't have to one-up anyone in this process. It's, you know, even though you're in these group interviews that are kind of weird, it's all about you and your match to the program and the program's match to you. It's really not about the 20 people getting interviewed at the same time. It's about you and how well you see yourself fitting there and how well the program sees yourself fitting in. So I'm going to pause there and take questions.
Katie, can I just throw one more
thing
in here? I know that where I'm at, the interview seems like it's where faculty are asking students questions, but actually a big part of the interview at our program is what we hear back when students stay at other students' apartments, because we put them up. I mean, just how you interact with everyone, you're always being watched. I mean, if you do well in an interview and the students come back the next day and say, you know, they stayed at my house and we have students saying stuff, applicants saying things that they just really shouldn't be thinking or saying, but they think because they are with other students, they can say things. But be yourself, and hopefully yourself is someone that even the students you're with who are in the program already are someone who they'd want to spend a year or a couple of years with in the case of postdocs.
Yeah. And I think that is a great point. And also the support staff that you interact with in the process. So we once actually recently – Well, it was at my first job. But anyways, we had a faculty candidate who treated the person who was booking his travel terribly. And we ultimately didn't hire him, because even though he was super shiny in his interviews and he gave a great job talk and he had a wonderful vita, the way he treated this person, and she told us, of course she told us, she was like, God, that guy was such a jerk to me. That was such an indication of how he was going to be as a colleague. And so we didn't hire him. And so it's not just the people you stay with, but everyone you interact with in the process. Questions? Okay. So you go on these interviews, and then you've got to make a choice. And I don't have any good advice for that one. It's hard. It's really hard. I flipped a coin, honestly. I mean, when you're at the point, and this goes for jobs and internships or anything, when you're at that point of making the final decision, you know, you can weigh the pros and cons forever and of each choice that you have. Ultimately, for every tough decision I've ever made, And this includes applying even to the University of Washington. That was actually a tough decision at the time and the place I was in my life, taking the job at UNM, which internship site to place first in my my ranking list, my first jobs, et cetera. You pour over it for weeks and weeks, and you try to make the most informed decision. And for all of those hard decisions, I ultimately flipped a coin. And my reaction to the flip told me what I really wanted to do. So it's not what the flip says. It's your reaction to what it says. And it's really an interesting exercise. I really didn't want the job at University of New Mexico. I really didn't. Is anyone from UNM on the phone? Oh, good. Tessa, you were here.
I was here, but now I'm U.S., so it doesn't count.
You can speak clearly
with us. Anyone who's coming to UNM. UNM's wonderful. I love it. It's great. I made the best decision ever. But I really didn't think I wanted to come here, and I had so many pro and con lists. I kept them, actually. It's kind of fun to look back at them now and again. Most of my cons were wrong, as it turns out, and I missed a lot of pros. But I ultimately flipped a coin, and there was a part of me that knew it was a good choice to come to UNM at the time. There was a really big part of me that knew that, and I flipped the coin, and I think it came up that I shouldn't take the job. And I was disappointed. For a split second, I was disappointed in that flip, and that's what told me I should take it. So there's something, you know, our intuition can be helpful in these matters. That being said, my first job was a terrible job, and I hated it. and I used the same process for that. And although in that situation, there was a part of me that knew it was the bad choice, and I just didn't listen to that part of me at the time. So I think a bigger point of all of this is you can course correct. So I took my first job. I discovered within my first 2 years that I really didn't like my job. And it was a tenure-track faculty position, but I was not doing well with my colleagues. I just didn't like my colleagues a lot. They didn't care about teaching at all, and I have always had a strong commitment to teaching. They really just were researchers, and even though we were all tenure-track faculty positions, they never interacted with undergrads at all, and I really value undergraduate education. And in my first 2 years, I decided I had to get out of there, and that's when I actually called Dennis Donovan and said, hey, can I be a soft money scientist at your center? And he said, of course, please come here and do that. So that's another point of this is that you can course correct, right? We always don't make the best decision. As far as internship, it's a year. You know, so if you make the bad decision there, it's a year and then it's over. And if you don't get your first choice, it's okay. It's really a quick year. You will ultimately get where you need to go. It can just take some time. I'm going to pause there.
Katie, I know that you'll agree with me on this. You talked about course correcting and internship, whether it happens on internship or in your final job, but whatever it is, the most important thing is to ask yourself, what am I learning here from this discomfort? What am I learning about myself? And so that your course correction is a good one.
Yeah, that's a really, really great point. And you know, it took me a while. This is my UNM is my fourth job, and so it certainly didn't happen all of a sudden that I was able to course correct. It did take time. But I will say that, you know, I really didn't think UNM was a great fit for me, and I took the job on the coin flip reaction, and it really turned out to be the best decision of my life. So that's another thing to know is that even if you're in a situation where maybe you're not getting the best internship, you're not getting the best job, you're not getting what you think is your dream job, you know, it's okay to throw yourself in and see how it goes. I in fact, when I left my first job for the soft money position at the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute, I actually didn't leave fully. I took a leave of absence from the first job because I wasn't sure if I wanted to do soft money. And so, you know, it, you never know. But and then I really liked that for the time that I was doing it.
I have something to ask you, and you'll enjoy this, no doubt. Would you please talk about the value of joining organizations like Division 50, and could you tell everyone how wonderful it is coming to conferences like CPA? Something tells me you'll enjoy that.
Yes, that. Yes. I also wanted to give a small plug for our new website, which we just finished this week. So if you haven't been to the new Society of Addiction Psychology website, the URL is addictionpsychology.org. It looks great. I'm so excited about it. But yeah, no, that has always been really, really helpful. So attending them, I attribute my attendance at conferences to most of my success in my career. Seriously, I think, you know, there's the hard work that goes on in between the conferences, but networking at meetings, small meetings are especially really, really helpful. So CPA is a meeting of under 200 people, lots of networking opportunities to talk to leaders in the field. And you might be thinking, well, what happens with that? You know, how does that get you anywhere? Well, I have a story for that. So early in my career, there was the alcoholism and stress meeting in Volterra, Italy. And it was the first time that meeting ever occurred. But I really wanted to go to Italy, and it sounded like a really interesting meeting. So I up and went and took a chance. I guess some of that risk-taking we started the call talking about. And while I was at this conference, actually before the conference even started, I had gotten dropped off this bus in Volterra, Italy, which is in the middle of nowhere. And I was walking around with my luggage after being on a, you know, red-eye flight, aimlessly, looking terribly, being semi-delirious. And I ran into Sarah Jo Nixon's graduate students. So actually, Lauren, you weren't there yet, if Lauren's on the call, but I ran into Robbie, who was a grad student, who was a research coordinator with Sarah Jo.
Oh, Robert Prather.
yeah. So I ran into Robbie, and he looked American, also somewhat disheveled from a red-eye flight, and also lost and had no idea where to go. And so we met, we teamed up, he found Sarah Jo, and that's how I met Sarah Jo Nixon on the streets of Volterra. But I got to talk to Sarah Jo Nixon, and then at the conference, I hung out with Sarah Jo Nixon and Robbie, and at that small conference, I really got to interact with people who later became so influential in my career. So Sarah Jo Nixon, 5 years ago, tagged me to help with this new conference we were going to do, Collaborative Perspectives on Addiction. I guess 6 years ago now is when she initially tagged me to help with that effort. And that has evolved into me helping to build CPA and now be president of the division. And really, I don't think if it was for that initial interaction with Sarah Jo at that meeting, I certainly don't think I'd be where I am with leadership of the division today. So it really is important, and that's just one small example. I also interacted at that conference with Peter Monti, and I didn't go to Brown for internship, and I was really torn about where to rank Brown versus Washington, and I ended up deciding I wanted to not move. And so I ranked Washington higher and ended up matching at Washington. But I always had kind of questioned it, and then at that conference got to interact with Peter Monti, and now, you know, interact with Peter Monti at a lot of conferences. So really, it's a great opportunity, and I especially value the smaller meetings over bigger meetings because of that personal interaction that you get.
You know, Katie, just because it fits in so well here, I feel like you and I are good friends now, and talk about coincidences. Remember where we first got to spend a substantial amount of time together? It was because of a snowstorm and an airport. where you
That's
were.
That's right. And then we got diverted on a plane, and yeah, that was.
We had never talked at length before.
No,
and
we hadn't.
There we were, trying to figure out whether even five people was going to show up at CPA that year because of the unexpected snowstorm.
Oh, that was awful.
we have. Only 4 minutes left. We have more than 20 people on the call. I only heard one hang up and then a beep, which usually means somebody's call was dropped and they got right back on. So this has been a terrific call with only 3 minutes left. Just logistically speaking, CPA is coming up. CPA is in Albuquerque, which should be really fun, your hometown, so to speak. It is in March, and you can get, and it's not that expensive, and you can get your hotel room now. And the one word you didn't use in describing conferences is energizing. I mean, I think they're super energizing and refreshing from the daily grind of working in your own institution, no matter how much you like your job. So I hope everybody on the line is planning to come to CPA. Katie, it's up to you now. We will stop in 2.5 minutes if you want to ask one more question or just say anything else, and then I'll say thank you and goodbye, even though I'd love to have another hour to keep doing this.
What I would say is, since we didn't get a lot of time for questions, please feel free to email me. I'm happy to take any questions. If you are shy to ask anything on the phone, email me. My email is kateiew@unm.edu. Please feel free to email me if you have any questions about anything we started talking about or anything that you want to know about me or my trajectory or you and your trajectory. Feel free to email me or call me. If you want to email me to set up a call, that would be probably the best because my schedule is a bit full these days. I will say about CPA, please come and please book your room early, especially students. We got an amazing rate for this hotel, $139 a night. And it's a gorgeous hotel in downtown Albuquerque. And I worry most about students who might have to pay more if that hotel books up. So please, if you're coming, well, please come. And please make your reservations early for the hotel. It's really quite lovely. It's a steal that we got it for $139 a night.
Very cool. And this podcast, like all the other ones, will be online. Now that we have our beautiful, shiny, new website, these recordings, I think, were put by our webmaster right on the front page. At least you can start out there and find them easily. And I think they're really a wonderful benefit of being part of Division 50. So all of that said,
can I chime in for just a minute?
Please,
this is
do.
This is Cindy Glidden Tracy, and I just wanted to say thanks for this podcast. It's been really interesting. I've been sitting here with Christina Lamb, who's the student rep to the Education and Training Committee, and we both really enjoyed listening in.
Thank you. Thanks, Cindy.
And we so appreciate Education and Training Committee kind of picking up here and moving forward with these calls. Katie, you said we didn't have time for questions. You got more questions than I think anybody else did, just so you know that.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. I thought I was blabbering on. But please email me if you have questions that didn't get answered.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. Thank you, everyone. This has been an absolute pleasure, as always. Dr. Witkiewicz, thank you, as always,
thank
for all
you,
you
Bruce.
Do.
Besides.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for organizing.
Absolutely.
Thank
bye-bye,
you.
Everyone.
Thank you, Katie. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks.